We're going through the Sermon on the Mount, and we've looked at the Beatitudes, and now we're looking at how Jesus applies the Beatitudes to various aspects of our life. And we've looked at various issues like lust and adultery and murder and divorce, which were all lots of fun. And this week we're coming on to oaths. And as we come on to oaths, I thought, oh, this would be an easy one. And as I was talking with colleagues about it on Monday morning, we came to the agreement that if you think this is easy, you haven't understood the text. Let me just read to you Matthew 5, 33 to 37. Again, you've heard it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but keep the oaths you made to the Lord. For I tell you, do not swear at all by heaven, or, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. Simply let your yes be yes, and your no be no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. This summer I went on a course, and we were studying how to work with 14 to 16-year-olds. Now, all the 14 to 16-year-olds I know are delightful, but I have heard that some of them are less so. And the guy who was teaching the course had 30 years' experience of working with very troubled teenagers. And he stood there and talked for 5 hours. And all of us just sat there in rapture, just really taken by what he was saying. And his message was very straightforward. He said, if you want to deal with these kinds of kids, you have to have one thing. You have to have a relationship of trust. If a relationship of trust does not exist, you're wasting your time. But if you're able to create a relationship of trust, then you're able to build something with young people like that. And that's what this passage is about. It's about trust. Oaths are nothing more than promises. Oaths deal in the currency of reliability. They're all about trust. Now, when we talk about making oaths, for us it's quite a formal thing, isn't it? Oaths is something you do in court. But actually, if you think about it, every time we're signing a check, if you still do sign checks, you're making an oath. You're making a written oath. You're staking your reputation. You're staking your financial reputation on that piece of paper. Now, if you remember in Jesus' time, it was different. Oaths were formal things that were done in public. There was very little written record. And so when people wanted to make stake a claim or do something legal, they would go in front of a group of people and make a public oath. And they would swear to do something, or they would swear to keep something. And Jesus is saying, in the case of oaths, there's a connection between who you are on the outside and who you are on the inside. If you like, there's an indissolvable link between who you are on the outside and who you are on the inside. And if you're a credible person, then that determines how people will respond to you. And if you're not a credible person, that will utterly undermine you in every moment of every day of your life. Taking an oath of itself is not wrong. Taking an oath in court is not wrong. Jesus is not saying don't take oaths. In Matthew 26, Jesus himself is in court. And he doesn't answer the judges, he doesn't answer the accusations until he is sworn under oath. And then when he is sworn under oath, he answers the accusations. In Genesis 15, don't turn to this, but in Genesis 15, God himself makes an oath. He swears by himself. He says, I swear I will do this. Jesus isn't saying, don't take oaths. What is he saying here? Well, let's look at verse 33. If you have it open, it'd be useful. He says, you've heard that it was said. You've heard that it was said, he doesn't say it was written. He said, you've heard that it was said. He's not critiquing or correcting the Old Testament. He's critiquing and correcting the guys who've been commentating on the Old Testament for the previous 1,000 years. And they said, do not break your oath, but keep the oaths you made to the Lord. Now, on the face of that, that sounds pretty good. They said, don't break your oaths, keep the oaths you make to the Lord. But what they actually meant was this. It says, you don't break the oaths you make with reference to God, but you can break the other oaths. You can break some oaths, but you can't break others. And what they'd done was they had said that honesty is determined by context. And it's determined by the level of sanction for dishonesty. Let me give you an example. They would say that honesty with your wife and children is less important than perjuring yourself in a court of law. They would say, don't perjure yourself in a court of law, but a little white lie to your nearest and dearest is quite acceptable. The religious people, of course, that Jesus is talking about lived in a theocracy, at least in their minds. And so for them, the highest point of authority was not the court of law. The highest point of authority was the temple and the religious law. And so when they swore, or didn't swear, for them perjury was not swearing on a legal basis, it was swearing by the temple. And so there was a difference in the types of oaths that they would give. They would say maybe, I swear by my hair. I swear by my hair. Or people could say, I swear to God. Or people say, I swear my mother's life. And if you think about it, swearing on your mother's life, for most people, is probably worse than saying, I swear to God. And what these oaths are there's a gradation of seriousness, a level of seriousness. And the teachers of the law created this exhaustive list of things you could say and then break your word. They said, if you swear by this, then you don't have to keep your word. But if you swear by that, then you do have to keep your word. A very good commentary on this whole thing is in Matthew 23. Could you turn to Matthew 23? Because it's worth looking at. 736 in the Church Bible. Matthew 23, verse 13 to 22. I just want to read it. The Sermon on the Mount is Jesus talking to people at the beginning of his ministry. Matthew 23 is Jesus slamming the religious people at the end of his ministry. This is the last week of his life. So he's quite polemic in what he says. Verse 13, woe to you teachers of the law, you Pharisees, you hypocrites. You shut up the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourself do not enter, nor will you let those who enter who are trying to. Woe to you teachers of the law, you Pharisees, you hypocrites. You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and then when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you are. Woe to you blind guides. If anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he's bound by his oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also say, if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gift on it, he is bound by his oath. You blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and everything on it. And he who swears by the temple swears by it and by the one who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and the one who sits on it. He's saying, you people are perverse. You're perverse. You're saying, it's okay to swear by the temple, but it's not okay to swear by the... it's okay to swear by the temple and break your oath, but it's not okay to swear by the gold in the temple and break your oath. It's okay to swear by the altar and break your oath, but it's not okay to swear by the offering on the altar and break your oath. He says, don't you see how crazy that is? Don't you see how perverse that is? How weird that is? It doesn't make sense. His application is in verse 34 of chapter 5. Do not swear at all. By heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot even make even one hair white or black. He's saying this, unless you're in a court of law, don't use oaths. In general speech, don't say, I swear. Don't use oaths. And if you're a kingdom person, and you're somebody who's living by kingdom truths, and this is the crunch, you won't have to. You won't have to. Because in the normal course of events, simply let your yes be yes and your no be no, what that means is that you'll be the kind of person who when they say yes, people take it. And when they say no, people take it. And when they say yes, people say, okay, he said yes, he's going to do it. And when you say no, they say, okay, he said no, he's not going to do it. You'll be the kind of person who is trustworthy, the kind of person who keeps their promises, the kind of person that is known for doing what they say they will do, the kind of person who doesn't fudge and is not hard or does not slither away, the kind of person who always tells the absolute truth. So when you say you will do something, people will not come to you and they'll say, are you sure you'll do it? And you will not have to answer, I swear to God I will. Because people will know that your yes and a no are what they mean. Now let me ask you this. Are you that kind of person? Are you that kind of person? If I were to go into your office, or we don't go to the office, and we were to ask the people who work with you, or your family members, are you that kind of person? That when you say something, you absolutely mean it, and they know you do. And when you say yes and say no, then people say, okay, he said yes and no, it's going to happen or it's not going to happen. Are you utterly transparent? Is the outward expression of your life inconsistent with who you are on the inside? Or is who you are on the inside perfectly clear to everybody on the outside? It's a very important question. I was once working with a guy, and before we started working with him, he and his family visited our family. And we were spending the day together, and I remember at one point, his daughter asked him a question, and he told her a white lie. And then he looked at me and he winked, like kids. And I worked for that man for 3 years. You know what? I never accepted a word he told me. I never took him once at his word. And I was wise not to take him at his word. I was wise not to take him at his word. This is a huge thing. Are you on the outside the same person as you are on the inside? Actually, there are two questions here. First question, are we the kind of people who offer the level of commitment that an oath represents? Are we the kind of people who offer to others the level of commitment that our oath represents? And I'll explain that in a minute. Secondly, are we the kind of people who are the same on the outside as we are on the inside? Let me go to the first point. And you may not have understood it, but I'm going to explain it. An oath is a promise. It's a statement of intent. It is an undertaking that we will do in the future what we promise to. Jesus is not saying don't make promises. He's saying keep your promises. Now for most of us, the idea of making promises and making commitments is absolutely counterintuitive. We live in a society where people say, I don't want to buy this tomorrow, today and be stuck with it tomorrow. I want to be free to change my mind. I want to be free to have and to do tomorrow what I will feel like having and doing tomorrow. And I don't want to determine today anything about tomorrow. A commitment is something that is very, very hard. A promise is something very, very hard for us to do. You say, well, why is that? Well, we've been spoiled literally by choice, haven't we? We have a level of wealth and a level of the things we can buy with our money that people in previous generations had no idea about. Today, if you want to go to, I don't know, holiday in Thailand, you save up for a couple of months and you get on a plane and go to have a holiday in Thailand. 50 years ago, you said to someone, a normal person, do you want to go to Thailand? Thailand was like, I'll never go there. I know it exists, but I'll never go there. We have a situation now where we have homes, ours included, you know, a TV in everybody's room. And you can find yourself in a situation where everybody is watching their TV in their room and watching that niche program that they enjoy that nobody else likes. And you say to yourself, is that right? Is that right? Are we really happier by getting exactly what we want, exactly when we want it? I think we've believed a lie. I think we've believed a lie that we will only be happy if we have exactly what we want on exactly the right time on any given day of any given month of any given year. We believe the lie that we have to have exactly what we want at any time, and then we'll be happy. And if we don't, then we'll be sad. And I believe this is why we're vague. This is why we're elusive. This is why we slither away when someone tries to nail us down. But let me ask you this. Is keeping our options eternally open really making us happy? Is true happiness, true joy, really to be found in having exactly what I want on any given day, regardless of whatever's going on around me? If it were, then rock stars and movie stars would be the happiest people in the world, wouldn't they? Because they got the money to have exactly what they want anytime they want it. And yet they're the more likely to kill themselves through drugs or commit suicide. The Bible teaches something else. That happiness is not about having something that suits me when I want it. and then picking up something else tomorrow, the next day something different. The Bible's answer to the question is much more different. One of the most important books in the Bible for us to study as a generation is the book of Ecclesiastes. Because in the book of Ecclesiastes, the writer has two models of wisdom. One model is the Greek model. And the Greek model says, you try everything, and then you find what suits you. And then he has the biblical model of wisdom, which is the wisdom, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. And the upshot of this, of Ecclesiastes, is this. The guy tries 1,000 different things. And at the end of his life, after having tried all these things, he turns around and he says to himself, meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. Having tried 1,000 different things, his answer is, everything is meaningless. The Bible says that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. The Bible says that, and I think actually psychology and sociology today reinforce it, is that true happiness does not come from an isolated, self-centered world. You will not be happy if you live in this isolated world just doing what you feel like doing. True happiness, true joy comes as a result of a life built together with other people, be they friends or marriage partners or colleagues or Christian brothers and sisters. True fulfillment, true happiness, true joy comes as we keep commitments and build relationships. Hannah Arendt said something quite complex, but I think it's worth repeating. Without being bound to the fulfillment of promises, we would never be able to keep our identities. We would be condemned to wander helplessly and without direction in the darkness of each man's lonely heart. Janis Joplin put it more prosaically. It's the heart afraid of breaking that never learns to dance. It's the dream afraid of waking that never takes a chance. It's the one who won't be taken who cannot seem to give. And the soul afraid of dying that never learns to live. Let me tell you something. You cannot trust your feelings. Do not trust your feelings. Your feelings are the product of how much sleep you had, what time of the month it is, of all kinds of turmoil inside your head. The feelings are not reliable. They're false friends. Sometimes they're stronger, sometimes they're weaker. You know what? If I went to work only when I felt like it, I wouldn't be there very much. I very rarely get up in the morning and say, I feel like going to work. Frankly, if I only came to church or prayer meeting when I felt like it, I certainly wouldn't have 100% attendance. We do things all the time because we know there's a payoff. We say no to our feelings all the time because we know there's a payoff. In the case of work, the payoff is wages, obviously, but also relationships and a feeling of accomplishment. In the case of relationships, the payoff is fulfillment. In the case of ministry and church, the payoff is joy. Joy. Promises, commitments, taking a position, being there for somebody, being part of something is what makes life meaningful. What we're doing here as a church on Sunday is not just coming together on Sundays. We are a group of people who are coming together and we're saying, I will love you and I will build my life with you and I will take time to do stuff with you even if it isn't what exactly what I feel like doing on that particular day, and I will build my life with you. And you know what? It happens 20 years down the road, you look over your shoulder and you know what you see? You see something beautiful. You see something worthwhile. You see something that has permanence. And you know what? You feel happy. You feel happy. You feel joy. Because you've achieved something. My first point is that promises are the keys to happiness. And that leads neatly to our second point. Isn't it just too hard to be honest? Isn't it too hard to be transparent? Let's face it, the key to relationships is transparency. The key to relationships is being who you say you are. Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. But it's a very difficult thing, isn't it, to be the kind of person who says yes and have people take them at their word and say, right, I'll trust you. Total transparency is difficult. Three reasons. First, I'm not English, but I understand that people feel this way, okay? We Americans have no problem with this, but a lot of people say, I can't be myself because if I'm myself, people will judge me. or they'll laugh at me, or they'll make fun of me. And so what I've got to do is I've got to create a barrier, create a wall, create an outward person that can show the world to keep myself safe. Others say to themselves, you know what, I'm such a rotten person. This is more me. If they knew what I was really like, they would never want to be with me. They would never want to be my friends. So I better present myself in company in a way that will be acceptable. Others say to themselves, you know, I'm so much cleverer than those people. I'm so much smarter than they are. I'm better educated. My culture's better. But I better not show that because they might be offended. So I'll just pretend. And if one or all of those motivations are lying in your heart, then you will not be able to build relationships. You will always be reserved. And who you are on the outside will be in sharp contradiction to who you are on the inside. And believe me, people know. People know. People know when they're dealing with a phony. They can spot a phony a mile off. And they know when they're being patronized. They really do. And they don't like it. And if you are saying to yourself, and if I'm saying to myself, I'd better somehow defend myself by building this wall and not being the same person on the outside as I'm in the inside, then I'm never going to be able to build relationships. I'll never know joy and happiness, and my life will head off in a direction of isolation and loneliness. And it's at this point we have to go to Jesus. Though he was God, he became man. And he hid his identity so he could maintain a relationship with us. It always struck me that Jesus never had a house. Someone came to him and said, I want to be with you. He said, fine. Foxes have their holes, birds have their nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. It always struck me that Jesus took 12 losers and spent his whole time just with those guys, building a relationship with them, even with one of them who's going to betray him. And at the garden, at the cross, what the terrible thing about the cross for him was not the physical pain and suffering, it was the loss of a relationship with the Father. And he sweat drops of blood because he didn't want to lose that relationship. And yet even there he said, not my will but yours be done. And he hung naked on a cross, utterly vulnerable. And I mean naked, not with a little loincloth, naked. And he was totally open. And what happened at that point was all of the rottenness that we're trying to hide and all of the things that we've been hiding away for years, God took all those things and he examined them and he put them on Jesus and he punished Jesus in our place. And then he rose from the dead and he's now able to live inside of us. You know how you can be transparent? You know how you can be different? You know how you can become a person who's really real? Is you come to him and you come to him mourning and saying, I'm sorry. You come to him poor in spirit and say, I've got nothing to bring. You come to him meek and saying, please, Lord Jesus, I want your agenda. And when you do that, four things happen. The first is this. When you come and you know forgiveness for your sin, and you know that the shame is dealt with, then you can be open and honest with other people. See, if you know that God's forgiven you, if you know that all of that is sorted, then you're able to be honest about your failure. You're able to be honest about who you are. Second thing, you come and that unconditional love, you just know that he cares for you, he loves you, and when you feel that love, then you don't have to worry about whether other people love you. You don't have to care about whether other people are saying, oh, you're a lovely person, we like you very much. Who cares? You've already got the love of Jesus in your life. You don't need anybody else's love. When you come and you realize he's committing to you, it fills you with a desire to commit to him and to commit to other people. When you come and you recognize that you're nothing without him, and you start to see other people, and you start to see how they compliment you, and how their differences fits with who you are, then you want to work with them. And at that point, something amazing happens. The mask falls away. We become the same on the outside as we are on the inside. We're set free to be transparent. Who we are on the outside becomes a crystal clear reflection of who we are on the inside. And then we start building those relationships that bring joy, that bring fulfillment. Now, I just want to finish with a quote. Matthew Paris, who's an atheist, lived his childhood in Africa and has visited it throughout the years. And he wrote an article about the experience of missions and his experience of African Christians. And I thought it was interesting. I'll read it and it'll also be on the screen. Traveling in Malawi refreshed another belief too. one I've been trying to banish all my life, but on observation I've been unable to avoid since my African childhood. It confounds my ideological beliefs, stubbornly refuses to fit my worldview, and has embarrassed my growing belief that there is no God. Now a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa, sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government projects, and international aid efforts. These alone will not do. Education and training alone will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good. I used to avoid this truth by applauding as you can the practical work of mission churches in Africa. It's a pity, I would say, that salvation is part of the package. But Christians, black and white, working in Africa, do heal the sick, do teach people to read and write, and only the severest kind of secularist could see a mission hospital or a school and say the world would be a better place without it. I would allow that if faith was needed to motivate missionaries to help, then fine. But what counted was the help, not the faith. We had friends who were missionaries, and as a child I often stayed with them. I also stayed alone with my little brother in a traditional rural African village. In the city we had working for us Africans who had converted and were strong believers. Now listen to this. The Christians were always different. Far from having cowed or confined its converts, their faith appeared to have liberated and relaxed them. There was a liveliness, a curiosity, an engagement with the world, a directness in the dealings with others. They stood tall. Whenever we entered a territory worked by missionaries, we had to acknowledge that something changed in the faces of the people we passed and spoke to. Something in their eyes. The way they approached you direct, man to man, without looking down or away. They had not become more deferential towards strangers, in some way less so, but more open. I want to tell you, you can be the kind of person who is transparent. You can be that person. It's not too late. You can be that person. You can be the kind of person who has the confidence just to be who you are wherever you are. To be the same here as you are in work. To be the same here as you are at college. To be the same here as you are at your home. You can be that person. But you can only be that person as the inside of you gets sorted. As the inside of you gets filled. As you have the confidence of knowing your sins are forgiven. As you have the joy of knowing that you're absolutely loved. As you have the peace of knowing that there's a plan for your life. And as you get that inside sorted, wherever you go, people will see you and they'll know you. And they'll say, well, that person is what they say they are. Their yes is yes and their no is no. And you can be the kind of person who meets that kind of joy and builds relationships that will fill you with joy. Are you ready this morning to let the mask down? The only honesty you need this morning is to be honest about your dishonesty. You only need to be honest about your dishonesty. You only need to come to God and say, Lord, I need you to change me. I need you to change me. Won't you do that this morning?